featuring timely, in-depth progressive analysis here on your listener-supported radio station on the web at WPKN.org.
And you are tuned to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and streaming online at WPKN.org. Stay tuned for the Organic Farm Stand coming right up.
Corn in the fields, and listen to the rice when the wind blows across the water. King harvest is surely come.
I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me. And I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say. For he's the one who hands me down my pay. Looks like this time I'm gonna get to stay. I'm a union man now all the way.
The leaves from the magnolia trees in the meadow. King harvest is surely come.
A dry summer, then come fall, which I depend on most of all. Hey, Rainmaker, can you hear the call?
Welcome to WPKN's Organic Farm Stand, which comes to you the first and third Thursday of each month. It is the first Thursday of September. My name is Richard Hill, and we are going to have a rockin' good show today. I want to welcome on the phone, which is, I think, a first, Guy Beardsley.
I am glad to be here. I even if on the phone, right.
Yeah, well, your voice is stronger than ever on that phone, and I don't care. I don't know if you want to tell us about some of your misadventures that have.
It's very simple, Richard. I was going out one night, rainy, and I have a light that's supposed to be activated by activity, and it didn't get activated, and so I tripped and fell over a box, which was in the way, and so landed on my right hip, and essentially it broke the right hip, and I went back in and went to bed, and then we took everything from there. Got an x-ray, and the doctor decided it would operate, and they did operate, and so I've been recovering ever since. Now I'm home now, got home yesterday, and so it's occupational therapy and physical therapy, and we'll take it from there.
It's incredible. You sound great, and I understand you are getting around.
I am, but I'm not yet on the tractor. That is a concern to me, but we'll get there, I'm pretty sure.
That's good news. Well, Chris Ferriero is also here. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Richard.
Good to see you.
Yeah, I tried to get here on time, but whatever.
Yeah.
So, Guy, I'm just kind of thinking we're kind of in a history moment here, and the first part of the show's history is last time we were on, it was the first time that you weren't on, I think.
Yeah, you had Maggie there.
Right, right.
And apparently you and Maggie hit it up pretty well.
Yeah, we did okay. We managed to fill the hour. and then this is this is the second part of the show's history, the first time you're on the phone and not here in person.
Right. Well, at least I'm there, partially, even if my voice is the only thing that's there. But that's okay. Fine. I'm pleased with this, and Richard got it all set up, and away we go.
Yeah.
I appreciate also you taking care of Maggie for the last previous 2 weeks. Right?
Sure.
Yeah, and we'll carry on without your biscotti and your cucumber relish.
You're going to have to rough it.
No cucumbers and no biscotti.
Right.
Well, Guy, nothing's changed here. I know you're probably not shall we say, in the driver's seat there in the tractor. But tell us the lay of the land looks like out there at the Eco Garden.
Well, right now we're putting the lavender to bed. And so this is what that means is we're trimming it back, and particularly on the lavender that we just planted this spring. We're putting it to bed. We are also getting green manure crop onto the fields, which are very important at this time that you get it. So if you plant it now, it will be up to maybe 6-7 inches by the time winter shows up. And it will help keep the soil intact and at the same time provide a good root structure so that when we do take it out next spring, it will provide some good nutrients for the ground. And, of course, we still have our markets and we still have our black garlic. Of course, we've got a lot of garlic, both regular raw garlic as well as black garlic. So, and when we have the different portions of the farm involved in the bakery. We do have a different baker. Becky is no longer our baker. I think we probably figured that one out probably a month ago or so. Anyway, there it is. There's biscotti and there's scones and cookies and, you know, the good things to eat, which I have to be very careful about, right?
Well, so in terms of production on the farm right now and what's going to market.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got, you know, September is the month in Connecticut in which everything that can grow is growing, with the exception of asparagus, which is an early crop, and some of the early onions and spinach, which are definitely spring crops. But we've got spinach planted, and we hope it's going to be operational next month. And then it will hold off, most of it will hold off, depending upon the kind of spinach, until next spring, in which case it will be really good in March. And if any of the kale holds over, and I hope it does, the early kale in the March and the very early part of April is just magnificent. You break off small chunks off the main stem and just pop it in your mouth, and it's sweet, delicious, and just a little bit crunchy.
Mm. And so what about the greens, the lettuces? Are you still...
Yes, definitely. You know, we say we still got the markets going and everything, like the tomatoes and peppers, eggplants, even the okra is really good right now. Squash, absolutely, right? Winter squash included, right? As I say, everything that can grow is growing in September in Connecticut, right?
And just give us a little survey on the types of kale and lettuce that you're producing.
Well, you know, most people think kale should be the very curly kale, like that would be winter boar and rip boar and anything that ends in a B-O-R. But there's some really good leaf kale, which kind of be Portuguese leaf, and another one which called, let's see if I can remember it, Beattie's Camden kale. That's also a really good one. And then, of course, you've got Russian red and Russian white kale. So, you know, you've got a varieties of kale out there. I like the larger leaf kale as opposed to that Scotch kale. So, because most people want to have a kale that's of some significant size, right? What, and I'm looking at something that Lisa just brought in, which is essentially a winter boar kale. And she put some carrots in there with it. So it looks pretty good, right?
Lunchtime. So
now, one of the great things about kale at this time of the year is the flea beetle damage is fading out because flea beetles can't stand some of the cooler weather which we're going to have. Flea beetles need nice, hot weather, which is what we get in June, July, August, and so forth, right? Anyway, we can get the flea beetles out of there, and then the kale is going to look really good.
What is Lacinato kale? Does that fit into?
Oh yeah, we got that too. There is two sizes of Lacinato. There is most of the Lacinato is a very thin leaf, which is also known as dinosaur kale because it's kind of wrinkly and kind of a thick leaf, but it's a very thin leaf. And most people call it dinosaur kale because it looks what they consider dinosaur skin to look like. And that, but there's also Rainbow Lacinato Kale, which comes in a variety of flavors, variety of colors, like red and purple, and some of even yellowish, as well as the usual reddish.
Thanks, Guy.
Okay.
And actually, I have a question, and that is, I believe you said kale and spinach. Are you winter over?
The kale will, in some cases, winter over, depending upon how bad the winter is and also where it's planted.
Sorry about that. Richard's trying to get our other
guests. Okay, we're still good. We're good. Did I answer the question?
Sure, and I believe you said spinach winters over, too?
Oh, yeah, spinach will winter over, once again, depending upon how severe the winter is. If you've got a good snow cover, you don't have to worry about any of it. But if you have a really cold January without a snow cover, you very well likely lose a considerable of both the spinach and the kale. Hopefully we'll have some good snow cover, and that really saves it. Right?
So as far as the plants, what do? You cut them back a little, maybe six
no,
inches.
No, don't
you just
cut
leave,
them back at all.
Whatever leaves are on there will protect the plant.
Right, just let them go, right?
Okay.
You don't have to cut them back whatsoever. Now, you can cut them back if you feel so desirable, but it's not necessary.
So basically, as long as you leave a few leaves on each plant, they're more protected?
As long as the plant stays upright, you could tell next spring or at the end of February whether you're going to have anything that's going to grow out of a kale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I'm not really much of a kale person. I know Richard is more of one. Are there any kales that are better to eat, or that could be eaten raw? Because I'm a salad person.
Well, you know, most kale is either sautéed or it's allowed to exist as a kale salad prime ingredient. But really, you can put kale in anything. You know, there's kale chips.
Right.
Kale is a great material to just add into anything that you're baking, for that matter.
Right. But as far as raw, are there any kales that are maybe more tender that would be okay for salads?
Well, to me, there is, and to me. Most people think that the winter boar type kale, which is a real curly kale, is better. And most of that is pretty tender. In other words, you can take a small leaf that's growing off the stalk and just snap it off in the spring and just pop it in your mouth. It turns out to be sweet and crunchy, as I pointed out earlier. But if you let it get big, which it will do, and then you want to use it. I'm sorry to keep giving you different information. Kale can be used very well in any sort of a smoothie, right? And it's really great in a smoothie as long as you can change the flavor and have something like you put in banana.
In other words, counteract that wonderful kale taste you're saying. Something sweeter to counteract the kale taste.
Yeah, right. It makes it a little more palatable. Most people, if they like something like that, want it to taste a little bit sweetish, right?
Okay. And so basically in the baby, most kale, like their baby form, they're more edible raw.
Right. I think so. And most smoothies will be that way.
Okay. So I believe we have Richard back with our guest.
Well, we are ready. Vince, we actually didn't mention this before, but we do have a special guest today on the phone. In addition to Guy Beardsley, we have Vincent Kay. He's the proprietor of Swords into Plowshares Honey. We had him on several months ago, and the thought was today that we would bring Vincent back to talk about this stage of the honey business, the life of the bee, the activities that the beekeeper and the bee are going through at this season, and to get an update on that. So Vincent is standing by, and I'm not sure if we have any.
Yeah, we're pretty good with the farm report.
Are we good with the farm report? So okay, well we're going to come. Of course, Guy Beardsley, please step in and lead us into a conversation with Vincent Kay. I know I'm not sure if, let me ask you actually before we get to Vincent, Guy, have you ever ventured into the activity of beekeeping and honey?
No, we hadn't, but my wife had for just a little bit, not enough to really amount to anything, but we were very familiar with how important the honeybees and the bumblebees are to pollination, absolutely. And if you know the doctor and the entomologist in the New Haven Agricultural Experiment Station has talked to us at some length about that.
That's right, Kim Stoner.
Yes, yeah, right.
Yep, for sure. Well, let's with that, let us introduce Vincent Kay from New Haven, Connecticut, proprietor of Swords Into Plowshares Honey. Vincent, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's really great to be back, and thank you, Richard.
My pleasure. Go ahead. You're roaming the fields now, or are you back at your base?
No, actually, I'm in New Haven inside the honey house.
Okay.
We're basically, I'm stranded here making candles, beeswax candles. I've got a vendor that's ordered a huge amount of them, so we're trying to fulfill that order. But in general, we've come to a kind of closure as far as harvesting honey. We like to do that while it's really warm out because it spins out of the combs when we bring it back to the shop here and we put it in a big centrifuge. The hot, humid weather acts like a lubricant to actually slide the honey out of the combs. And so we like to get all of our honey extracted by September 1, and we just about made it this year. And we harvested probably anywhere between 12 and 15 tons of honey, which is a fair to good year. It's not a great year, but again, we've been hit with these cold, rainy springs, and that limits the time available because, of course, the bees don't fly, and the blossoms sit there and bloom, and they rot on the bushes and trees. And so, you know, it's a washout, quite literally. So we pick up usually a surplus honey because, of course, the honey is the bees' food as well. But we start seeing a surplus arriving in the hives, usually in June, and that coincides with the blooming of here in this part of the state, linden trees and a lot of the tulip poplar. And most of the honey that we gather is from trees and shrubs. I mean, Connecticut is no longer agricultural. And so it's hit or miss. You're not in some ways you're not depending upon you know, farms for forage for the bees' food, but at the same time you're also dependent upon the weather. So it's a little tricky to thread the needle, but it's we're coming to a close and so we're switching over now to making sure the bees have what they need going into the winter. Which we harvest honey, but we have to leave them quite a bit of honey. But we're putting on mite treatments, and we're putting on, if any of them need feeding, we're feeding them. Although there's a lot of things blooming right now, as I'm sure Guy knows how important bees are to agriculture. And thank you, Guy, for saying that, because they really are. And not just honeybees, but butterflies and bumblebees and blue orchard bees. And there's a host of pollinators here in Connecticut that... our food supply really relies on the pollen needs to be transferred by insects. It's not necessarily you'll have some pollination, but it won't be adequate to harvest a really good crop. So insects and honeybees in particular are very important. And right now we have a lot of things blooming. We have Joe Pieweed, we have ironweed, Japanese knotweed, goldenrod. We've just come out of a really nice period of weather where we had a great sweet pepper bush or clethra harvest, and we actually let the bees have that. But it's a flower that grows in the swamps, and it's a really delicate flower, and it's just beautiful. The aroma, you walk through the woods, and there's perfume everywhere. It's so fragrant, and it's just beautiful. And so the bees were able to gather that nicely out in particular where we have a lot of bees in Madison. And Westbrook, where we have a lot of swamps around them. So we were pleased
Michael, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Somewhere along the line, I have read that there is raw honey and then there's other types of honey. Could you kind of give everybody an idea of what kind of honeys there are? They all seem to be in the same kind of jars, but there's different signs on the front of them.
Yeah, and a lot of it is just that, signs on the front of them. And a lot of it is an advertising gimmick. It's like saying, is honey kosher or is honey raw? It's kind of the same thing. I mean, it's, you know, of course it's kosher. I mean, honeybees gather in a pure environment or as pure an environment as we have here in Connecticut. And it's, anyhow, raw honey in particular, I'll address that, is probably less filtered than some of the other honeys, which, you know, are not quote-unquote raw. We just filter ours through cheesecloth, and so all the pollen and stuff is still in the honey, but we try to get the clean dirt out, you know, an occasional bee wing or a leaf or a stick or something like that, a piece of grass. All that has to come out. We don't believe in putting that in the jar and selling it as raw honey. Although there are some companies that leave a lot of debris in the honey, and I'm surprised it sells at all. But you want to keep the goodness, and you also don't want to heat it. And so we do not heat the honey. Occasionally, you know, in the winter, we do have to warm it to pour it. But we've been pouring honey all summer long into jars and containers and 1,000-pound tanks, filtering, and it basically pours very nicely in the hot weather. So we don't have a problem there. But some of the big companies do overheat the honey, and that's a longer discussion. But you don't want to heat it, and you don't want to overfilter it, and that'll give you raw
honey. When you say heat it, what temperatures are we talking about?
140 degrees.
Oh my goodness!
Right. So that would be overheating, Vincent.
Would be overheating. If we have to warm it, we're talking, you know, we usually warm it no warmer than a hot summer day. You know, maybe 85 degrees, and for a very brief time, just so that the spigot, we can work the spigot on the big tanks. But it's even over 120 degrees, you're losing a lot of the nutrients, and you're killing a lot of the bacteria that is good in the honey. So it's there.
That's what I think is very important. That I know when we make our black garlic, it has to stay at no more than 86 degrees. For 12 days.
Well, that's a hot summer day.
Much
that's
higher
right.
than that, you are losing a lot of the nutrients which you otherwise would need to have.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you have honeys that have different sugar molecules, different flowers. They're not all the same. Honey comes from hundreds and hundreds of different flowers here in Connecticut. I mentioned a few of them. But if you look closely, there'll be little chickweed blooming in March and other things that, you know, the bees, if you look closely, they're on it, even in the cold weather. They stay close to the ground, and if they can come out even for 30 minutes in a day, they'll do that. But all of these honeys get combined, all these sugar molecules, I mean natural sugar, get combined in honey. And for people who don't know, I mean, bees gather nectar, which is the sap, just like maple syrup, like sap from the maple trees. And the bees bring it back, these nectars from different flowers, and they put it in the comb, and then they fan their wings over it to evaporate the moisture. And then they know exactly when to stop, and then they seal it over with beeswax. Now, of course, beeswax is produced from a gland on their abdomens, so it's obviously a non-petroleum product, but they seal this over, and the honey will then maintain purity in a hydrostatic solution for eternity. They have pulled honey out of the tombs in Egypt, and it's perfectly fine.
Wow.
It never goes bad, provided the moisture is controlled. And that's why the bees seal it over with wax, so that it controls the moisture. So if you didn't control the moisture, it would ferment, and then you would have mead. So there's people that add water to honey so that they can make a concoction, you know, and it ferments, and you have mead. But in general, what we do is bring back the boxes of honey from the bees, and of course the frames are extremely heavy, and it's usually a god-awful hot day. But we bring them back, and then we slice with a steam knife the wax and expose the honey. And then we put the frames into the extractor, which is a big centrifuge. It's spun out, and then it gets filtered through cheesecloth into big holding tanks. So,
Richard, Michael, can you tell us how we make beeswax, or how is that produced?
You're talking Vincent. Vincent, right?
Oh, yeah, Vincent, right.
That's okay. Not at all. Beeswax, again, is produced by the bees themselves, a gland under their abdomen, and it comes off in little flakes, and it's the color of it is snow white when it's first produced by the bees, and they roll it out with their legs and their mouths, and they kind of knead it and get it malleable to the point where they can make the shape of the comb. So they actually make the comb out of this beeswax. What we do with all the cappings that we slice off of the combs to expose the honey is we let those drain by gravity into a tank, and then sometime during the winter I take the cappings and I boil them in hot water, and they separate, and we end up with these big chunks of beeswax, and we then make candles out of it. So it's quite a process. It takes quite a bit of time. And but it fits into our annual kind of work schedule pretty well. So we use up everything that the bees produce.
And that
how many kinds of honeybees are we working with here, or do you work with?
I have about 450 hives. Wow. In probably almost 20 different towns from Westbrook to Oxford. We, again, keep them as far away from, I hate to say it, as far away from people as possible for obvious reasons. We don't want people getting stung. We usually have in a bee yard no less than 20 hives, no more than 50, depending upon the forage available in that particular area. We try to keep away from, I hate to say, things like golf courses and places that use a lot of chemicals. And sometimes that would include a commercial farm that may be on a spray routine. Certainly orchards don't have their own bees because of the insecticides they spray. So we don't keep bees close to orchards at all. But some of the vegetable farmers are working with beekeepers to come up with a window of toxicity, which is less, through the IPM program, the Integrated Pest Management Program, which the state of Connecticut has developed years ago. It works, and mostly, and we've had pretty good luck with keeping bees on vegetable farms, but we don't keep that many. We don't push our luck, but we're happy to have access to, and of course, we sometimes pay for permits, but we keep bees on utility land and public utility land. And this is something that I think people should understand. I mean, one of the things people can really help with as far as keeping bees healthy is planting food. And when I say planting food for insects or pollinators, there's a lot of things that can be done. I just bought two 1-pound packages of clover seed. Now, each package cost $11, but I stopped in at one of the feed and grain stores, and I said, "Oh, well, let me get some of this, and we'll spread it in some of the bee yards." And people can do that in their yard. And I think the concept of the American lawn needs to change. I think the chemicals that people are putting down, whether it be herbicides or fungicides or pesticides or insecticides, are really overdoing it in your lawn. It's these companies are trying to sell products. You're poisoning your wells, your pets, your children. And I think instead, things like planting clover and other things like butterfly bush and, keeping things a little bit more natural looking rather than the, pure green blanket of grass is far more beneficial to insects, to birds. It provides a lot more food. Unfortunately, and I have to say this, sometimes the state of Connecticut is not on our side for beekeepers. There's a movement that's out there now, not just the state of Connecticut, but I think a lot of people have bought the theory, hook, line, and sinker, to get rid of invasive species of flowering plants. And this is things like Japanese knotweed and autumn olive, which, of course, the state brought in when they built the highways during the 50s. They're the ones that put it there in the first place. But these are incredible sources of food for both birds and insects. And the most beautiful honey comes out of Japanese knotweed. It looks like a glass of red wine, and it's just delicious.
Wow.
It's one of those things that, I mean, I understand that people may need to eradicate it from their yard, but I think getting back to the public utility companies and the state, I think they have a responsibility as stewards of the land to, I mean, their business may be selling water or electricity or whatever it might be, but we've given them the trust of managing the land around their products. And in so doing, I think a lot of them are just hyper-manicuring these areas with herbicides and mowing and cutting with these flailing mowers. There's no good to come of it all. It really needs to stop, and people really need to allow things to bloom. You know, I see people cutting huge fields of goldenrod that are in bloom now. Well, can't you wait a week or 10 days? Because, yeah, you can cut it, but, you know, the value of it now while it's in bloom is just incredible to all of the insects.
Can you tell the difference between goldenrod honey and, say, clover honey?
Of course. A lot of the honeys from different sources are a different color. So, for instance, clover honey is very light in color. Japanese knotweed is red. Goldenrod has a certain aroma and is darker in color, kind of an amber color, but darkish. And you know, we allow most of the fall flowers to the nectars to be gathered by the bees to for themselves to survive the winter. So our harvest begins. Excuse me?
Joe pieweed.
Joe pieweed, ironweed, jewelweed. All of these things are great sources of nectar for honeybees. Yeah.
Wow.
We're speaking with Vincent Kay. He's the proprietor of Swords into Plowshares Honey, which is, I think, one of the great success stories in terms of cottage industries around the state of Connecticut. It's amazing. Vincent, I wonder how much time and what your strategy is for distributing your product, because, you know, you're up against, you know, multinational corporations who have distribution networks that are probably so automated fearsome.
Well, I think fortunately we're small enough where we're not a threat to these companies, but I think doing business the way I like to do it is meeting the person who's going to be selling your product, giving them a sample, and shaking their hand. And so that works pretty well. And if you're not able to do that, then I think you're too big for your britches, and you need to go back to business school, you know?
Vincent, it is great to see your product in, like, the large supermarkets, because mm-hmm. I did notice it in there. You know, I won't yep. mention any names, but...
Yeah, but, you know, that's also been the same kind of handshake relationship, because I've met the owners of those supermarkets or whatever it may be, and we've shaken hands and we've talked. And so you can't just sell honey at a farmer's market and expect to make a living. I mean, when I started thinking about doing this full time, I had to sit down with a lot of spreadsheets and figure out my expenses and you know, also how we are going to sell this product year round. So, and how many hives that would take, and et cetera. So, you know, we've had terrible years, but we're able to survive. Most of the years are fair to good, and we manage it that way. You know, that's a beekeeper's stewardship or animal husbandry that needs to happen. You have to think about how you're going to raise. Of course, the bees exist, but you're raising them to an extremely high density population to coalesce or be coordinated with, hopefully, a blooming flower so that you can maximize what they bring in and what you can take from them and leave for them. And all those balances need to happen. And it's been fun. It's challenging. It's fun. It's competitive out there, I'll tell you that, the business world. But, you know, I've enjoyed it. I love what I do, so it's great.
How many times a summer do you harvest from the hives?
Just once.
Okay. And in that process, go ahead.
Sorry.
In that process, you said, you know, you like the warm weather can help you in terms of the physical process of getting the honey out of the hive. Just can you describe what happens when you approach the hive to harvest honey? And you, now we're talking roughly in mid-August or something, or what point?
We started this year harvesting in around July 4th, July 4th weekend, because we have so many bees in different locations that it takes a couple of months, well, at least a month, perhaps almost 2 months to get through them all. But like I said, most of the apiaries, which are the bee yards, a fancy word for bee yard, has anywhere from 20 to 50 hives in it. And each hive has, approximately at that point in the year, 80,000, 60,000 bees, something like that. So there's a lot of bees when you approach a bee yard. We usually have them in, rural settings, so we're off the grid, so to speak. We're out there, and it's absolutely beautiful. But it's hot. You're in a bee suit. You've got heavy gloves on. And we had an incident this year where one of my longtime helpers had a bad reaction to the bees. She was stung. And it just, you don't know when your time is up. You can be stung many times and not have a reaction, and then all of a sudden it happens. So, Grace, we want you back, but you got to go through those allergy tests. But that's a whole other ball of wax, so to speak. So we were kind of down a person in our chain, our supply chain for harvesting. But what we have to smoke them mildly. We use a smoker, usually with just grass or leaves in it, and just to calm the bees. And then we use a bee blower, which is sort of like a leaf blower. It doesn't hurt the bees at all. But we blow them out of the honey boxes, not the nest, not the brood chamber, but the honey boxes, which are on top of the brood nest. And then we rush them to the truck, put them under a tarp. And then as the truck fills up, we decide that we've had enough for a day or a session, morning or afternoon. It's extremely hot work. I'm so grateful for the helpers that I have, because it's just, it borders on a real meltdown. I mean, it's just so hot, and you have so many bees trying to sting you, and the air is just full of bees, and the sound is beautiful, and the smells are great. But they kind of know that you're taking their honey, so it tends to be a little chaotic sometimes, But anyhow, that's sort of how we manage it in the field. We try to go in quickly, and again, our goal is to harvest honey, so the health of the bees is a primary goal. So we're very careful about that.
When you blow them out of the honey chamber, I guess you said.
Yeah, honey box. Yeah,
you're blowing them. You said into a where they're going to be covered by a tarp. Is that what you?
Oh no! They're being blown onto the ground. They fly right back to their hive.
I see. Okay, so yeah. you're just getting them out of there. So you
just
can...
the honey boxes get put onto the truck without bees. You don't want to bring all those angry bees back with you. Oh my God! No.
All right. So I misunderstood that.
Yeah.
So this is a fantastic story, Vincent. Give us just an insight or some kind of information about comparing an operation of your size, where you have thousands of hives to manage, and you're harvesting.
Well, hundreds, anyhow. But yeah.
And you're bringing this product to market, and there's a whole distribution issue. To somebody who says, you know what, bees, I want bees on my backyard, and I want to start this process up. Just can you give us a sense of what such a person would need to do to start that process, and the kind of comparison of your operation to that very simple.
Well, I understand. Well, we actually, I mean, it's both a blessing and a curse that more bees are being kept by beekeepers. And I say that, I'll take the positive point of view first. I think it's a great consciousness to have the honeybees in somebody's backyard. I think it makes you think about the environment almost daily. And the bees are a link to that. And They're kind of like the canary in the coal mine, because when something goes wrong, if your neighbors are spraying, the bees will be dying in your yard in front of the hive. So there's that element, which is a good one, and I think the more people who have beehives, the better. However, we kind of distinguish beekeepers and then beehavers, because a lot of the people who have hives have them, but they don't really know anything about them. So the only thing I would say, if you're going to get a hive, you're going to get it in the springtime, and you have all winter to think about it and to read about it and educate yourself, because with that animal husbandry, you have a responsibility to keep healthy bees. The negative part is that as a commercial beekeeper, certain areas, bees are in some ways a little bit aggressive towards each other. So a really strong hive will go to a weaker hive and take the honey, overcome the honey. But the reason that weak hive is weak is probably because it's diseased. And there are a number of bee diseases which don't affect people, don't affect the honey, stuff like that. But it affects the general welfare of the hive and whether it's going to live through a winter. So it's important for people to educate themselves on recognizing disease, treating for parasitic mites, which will kill a hive, and all the little things that make a hive healthy and survive till the next year. So we don't encourage it, but we do sell bees to other beekeepers, and we do that in the spring. We try to give them as much information as we can, but it's, you know, we don't want the hobbyist beekeeper, so to speak, to become sources of infection for some of our large apiaries. So we kind of, it's a double-edged sword, that's all I can say.
Interesting.
And we just try to keep people informed about what they should be doing at a certain particular time in the year with their bees.
Mm-hmm. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
It's like the apple orchard that, you know, you've got a nice clean orchard, but the guy down the street's got a diseased crab apple tree, and, you know, the scale and scab and all the diseases that are there are jumping because the wind carries these spores in the, you know, they just, it's very contagious. And all of a sudden you wonder why, you know, your orchard is got all these things that you never had before. So it's the same principle.
Yeah.
So Vincent, say for the home, what do you distinction between beekeepers and beehavers? So a beehaver, someone wants to have a hive in their backyard. It sounds like it's not something like you buy the box and then you buy the bees and then just sit.
You can do all that.
Right,
a beehaver just doesn't know what they're doing.
Right, and it also requires a certain amount of attention and maintenance, too.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Vincent.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's the major problems you've got with, whether it's bears or insects or, diseases or what?
Well, I knock on wood, the state has been... the DEP has been moving bears around to try to get them to breed and get a population of bears so they can open a hunting season. I'm totally against that, but that's a different issue for another program. But I would say probably three-quarters of our apiaries now have solar electric fencing.
Uh-huh.
And it's been a huge expense, but we've done it, and we do a really good job. These fences don't hurt the bear at all. But it does zap them with 10,000 volts, so it'll throw you on your keister. I've been zapped by them accidentally, and it's basically a marine battery with a solar panel that trickle charges it. And the wires are no more than 4 foot high, but there may be 7 or 8 wires, so they're spaced pretty close together, and it allows us to sleep at night because they work. And we've had episodes where bears have challenged the fence, trying to dig under or climb over, and the fences have worked and stopped them. But you're looking at probably $1,500 to $2,000 a fence.
Wow.
You know, it's not that cheap. And, you know, if we've got, on the left side, we probably have at least 15 fences. So it's a chunk of money. It was a chunk of commitment to do it because there's so many bears right now in so many different areas where we keep bees. Yeah.
Now, If somebody wants your honey, what is your what's your trade name?
Swords into Plowshares Honey.
Okay.
I was told 35 years ago that I would never sell a jar of honey with that name, and here we are 35 years later. So that's a it's a long haul.
it's an amazing project, and also just to remind folks, I think we mentioned it last time you were on that. Just tell us again what the meaning of swords into plowshares, why you chose that.
Well,
name.
It's an old adage from the Bible, from the Old Testament, and from Isaiah. And it's a common sense to me adage that people can get along and that they really should be committed to nonviolence and certainly not go to war. Nations shall learn war no more. So in a way, you know, I was involved in the anti-nuclear movement years ago, and I took that as something that always stuck in my mind. And I said, well, we're just going to put it on the label and see how that goes. And that's what's happened. And I'm quite proud of it, and I'm quite proud of the people who have supported it. And again, my helpers. And, you know, you get involved with all these different groups, and we're so happy that we're giving back in small ways. We give a number of scholarships to the New Haven Public Schools every year, and this year for the first time we had a painted beehive contest, which involved all the artists down at the Educational Center for the Arts in New Haven. And the winner of that contest was awarded a scholarship to go to college. And so, you know, we do stuff like that. It's just a lot of fun. It's just a lot of fun being involved with people. So.
And the other thing I think that's fascinating about your operation is that your honey processing center, if I'm not mistaken, I used to live on Foster Street, and you were right behind me on Nicole, or is it McCann?
That's where I'm sitting right now.
Right, okay. So, I mean, and one day, you showed me the operation up there, and it's basically, like a little outbuilding right next to your clapboard.
It's like a little carriage house, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a lovely thing. Next door to the house, there was a little pen with some guinea hens and chickens.
Yeah, we still have chickens here.
Chickens.
And it's just wherever I have been, I've always had birds, and it's like my little tree house here. I wish it was four or five times as big. Of course, every mechanic or every farmer wishes that for space wise, but it's one of the things we've had to do is brace the flooring because honey is very heavy, and when we get close to 10,000, 15,000 pounds on the floor up here, we get a little nervous, so we tend to transfer it to the first floor, which has got a concrete base on it. So, I think it'll hold 20,000 pounds up here, but it is pushing it.
That's kind of like PKN with all the CDs and LPs. We had to move half them out of there because the physical plant was saying the building was going to collapse. But this is, it's just, I love the fact that you're right there in the East Rock section of New Haven, which is, it's an urban operation, but it has, when you walk into your little section there, your little driveway, down your driveway, and enter that world, it is like being, in a rural setting almost.
It is. Unfortunately, people, they want to come in here a lot, and I'm like, well, it's, we do have bees here. So there are a number of hives here, and it's, they're kind of a wild creature, even in East Rock. Certainly we have, Boy Scout and Girl Scout troops come in, and we try to make ourselves available for educational purposes as long as, the curriculum that they're studying is relevant. And that they use the information that way. So we try to give back a lot or more and more. And when we have the time, but usually during the summer, we can't. It's just too busy. And we also grow garlic, too. So that's been a new project and a new business venture. So we don't do black garlic, Guy.
Well, that's okay. But I can talk to black garlic. Richard, I'd like another ask another question.
Sure.
If you could talk to it a little bit about it, because most of the people at my brother's orchard and cider mill carry honey, which most of the part has been come from the apple trees and peach trees and so forth. Now, people ask for local honey, and they seem to think that that is much more impressive a way of improving the immune system than honey that's not local. Could you talk to that a little bit?
Sure. Well, obviously, there is quite a bit of anecdotal evidence that suggests that consuming honey with the pollen that you may be allergic to is a good way to build up your immune system. I'm not a doctor, but there's enough anecdotal evidence that it works. So if it works, great. And honey sales are great. So we like that. And the main thing is that it works, and it's a pleasurable product. And the idea is to eat local honey. It's a little bit misleading in the sense that goldenrod is the same in Canada as it is in New Haven. It's the same flower with the same pollen. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're talking about is the concentration, the particular concentration that you may be allergic to in that particular area. So unfortunately, goldenrod gets a bad rap, but it's not even wind-blown pollen. It has to be transferred by insects. But certainly, yesterday I was walking in a field, and I said to my helpers, I said, look at that. I've never seen a cloud of ragweed dust blowing across the field. And it was literally because we had some gusty winds. And I just said, oh, my God, it's achoo. You know, if you were allergic to that, that would be certainly something to have, to somehow get or consume so that maybe you could build up your immune system. So anyhow, getting back to local honey is good, I think, for that reason. And some people just enjoy the fact that, you know, the flowers in their area are producing a product that tastes so wonderful. So in any event, that's my read on local honey. But the flowers are the same. I think it's the concentration of any particular flower that you might be allergic to.
So now I notice that when our lavender is in bloom, we have about 800 lavender plants.
Oh,
the
nice.
Bees are really into it. They seem like
they are.
In it.
Yeah. They love lavender. They love mint. They're on my mint, although I should be trimming that back now. I'm a little late. But they love all the savory little flowers. They love oregano and thyme and all those blossoms. But lavender in particular, I wish I had a field of lavender because I'm sure the honey would be absolutely delicious if you could get it.
There is a difference there in the lavender honey then, right?
Oh, all the flowers have unique little flavors. It's just that it gets mixed together when we extract it and put it into tanks to hold. But I mean, if you had a huge number of those bushes and fields of it, you could probably extract just lavender honey. So this is how you get the flavors that you see. Sometimes you'll see a clover honey or blueberry honey. Well, you know, you probably, you know, are getting honey from a huge area that has nothing but blueberry bushes or clover fields for miles and miles. So they're selling you what they think or hope is pretty much, and probably is, predominantly that particular nectar.
Vincent.
I've seen somewhere along the line that they said, maybe it was you that says, your bees go after the white clover, but not the pink clover.
That's correct, because their tongues aren't long enough to get the red clover.
That's it, right.
The red clover is still very nutritional for the soil and provides a good nitrogen binder. Right. But it's mostly visited by bumblebees because their tongues are longer.
Now that's interesting.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to, unfortunately, cut us short because we are running out of time. I do want to mention we're speaking with Vincent Kay and, of course, Guy Beardsley on the phone. Thankfully, his voice is just as strong as ever. Vincent, we had discussed the idea about having you do a short spot on once a month on the Organic Farm Stand, where you would come in and just give us an update on the bee culture, the bee processes that go on all year round, and the type of preparations and work you do during the winter around this. And then as we get to the summer, we can have these longer reports. But
that sounds great, Richard. I think you're going to have a hook, though, to pull me off off the phone because I think the biggest problem is going to be keeping it short.
Yeah. Well, we can maybe pick a topic for each show, but why don't we start that in October? So we'll have your first five to 10 minute B update starting as part of our show one time each month.
I'll have to rehearse the minute part.
Yeah.
So plus, that's, I don't have any problem at talking. You do a super job.
Plus, thank you, Guy, and it's been a pleasure to speak with you, even though you have a bum hip, I'm sure, and I wish you well, and I hope a quick recovery, because those things can be a nag.
I need all the help I can get right in there.
Well, I think, you know, the spring is, you should be thinking about your transplants and getting everything ready for spring, because next year's a new year.
Right.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot for joining us this week, Vincent.
Thank you so much, guys.
And we'll talk to you soon again. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
And this is the Organic Farm Stand. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Chris Ferriero, Richard Hill, Guy Beardsley, maybe even in the flesh. But in any case, on the phone, his voice always ringing clear and guiding us in our understanding of organic farm culture and the whole organic world. So thank you for listening to WPKN's Organic Farm Stand. Stay tuned for some announcements. And after that, Peter Beauchamp's All Mixed Up.
Sensation. Love, sensation. Organic love. Oh, 100%.
Programming support comes from New Morning Market, family-owned in Woodbury since 1971, specializing in local and organic with fresh produce, grass-fed meat, farmstead cheeses, foods for special diets, and healthy dishes prepared daily. NewMorningMarket.com.
All the news that's fit to print, and democracy dies in darkness, two taglines of two major American news organizations, the New York Times and the Washington Post. WPKN is proud to offer digital subscriptions to both publications. Become a monthly sustaining supporter at $15 per month, and you can have your pick of either paper for a one-year subscription. So if you already have the New York Times at home, consider adding the Washington Post. In the process, you're helping support WPKN, nonprofit community radio. Make your sustaining donation to WPKN today, online at WPKN.org. It will be a decision you will enjoy every single day of the year.
Summer is officially over and the kids are headed back to school. Time to get back to business, and that's what WPKN is about to do. Did you